23. Nothing was clear to Susan until she saw the man with the long red hair and the straw hat which did not quite obscure his lamb slaughterer's eyes. The man with the corn shucks in his hands. He was the first. Just a farmer, she had glimpsed him in the lower market, she thought, had even nodded to him, as country folk do, and he back to her, standing by himself, not far from the place where Silk Ranch Road and the Great Road intersected, standing in the light of the rising moon. Until they came upon him, nothing was clear. After he hurled his bundle of corn shucks at her as she passed, standing in the slowly rolling cart with her hands bound in front of her and her head lowered and a rope around her neck, everything was clear. "Char you tree," he called, almost sweetly uttering words of the old people she hadn't heard since her childhood, words that meant come reap, and something else as well. Something hidden, something secret, something to do with that root word, char, that word which meant only death. As the dried shucks fluttered around her boots, she understood the secret very well. Understood also that there would be no baby for her, no wedding for her in the fairy distant land of Gilead, no hall in which she and Roland would be joined and then saluted beneath the electric lights, no husband, no more nights of sweet love. All that was over. The world had moved on, and all that was over, done before fairly begun. She knew that she had been put in the back of the cart, stood in the back of the cart, and that the surviving coffin hunter had looped a noose around her neck. "Don't try to sit," he had said, sounding almost apologetic. "I have no desire to choke you, girlie. If the wagon bumps and you fall, I'll try to keep the knot loose, but if you try to sit, I have to give you a pension. Her orders." He nodded to Rhea, who sat erect on the seat of the cart, the reins in her warped hands. "She's in charge now." And so she had been. So as they neared town, she still was. Whatever the possession of her glam had done to her body, whatever the loss of it had done to her mind, it had not broken her power. That seemed to have increased, if anything, as if she'd found some other source from which she could feed, at least for a while. Men who could have broken her over one knee like a stick of kindling followed her commands as unquestioningly as children. There were more and more men as that reaping afternoon wound its shallow course to night. Half a dozen ahead of the cart riding with Rhymer and the man with the cocked eye, a full dozen riding behind it, with Reynolds, the rope leading to her neck wound around his tattooed hand, at their head. She didn't know who these men were or how they had been summoned. Rhea had taken this rapidly increasing party north a little farther, then turned southwest on the old Silk Ranch Road, which wound back toward town. On the eastern edge of Hambry, it rejoined the Great Road. Even in her dazed state, Susan had realized the Harridan was moving slowly, measuring the descent of the sun as they went, not clucking at the pony to hurry, but actually reining it in, at least until afternoon's gold had gone. When they passed the farmer, thin-faced and alone, a good man, no doubt, with a freehold farm he worked hard from first gleam to last glow, and a family he loved, but oh, there were those lamb-slaughterer eyes below the brim of his battered hat. She understood this leisurely course of travel, too. Rhea had been waiting for the moon. With no gods to pray to, Susan prayed to her father. "Da, if these there help me to be strong as I can be, and help me hold to him, to the memory of him, help me hold to myself as well, not for rescue, not for salvation, but just so as not to give them the satisfaction of seeing my pain and my fear. And him, help him as well. Help keep him safe," she whispered. "Keep my love safe. Take my love safe to where he goes. Give him joy in who he sees, and make him a cause of joy in those who see him."
"Prayin', dearie?"
the old woman asked without turning on the seat. Her croaking voice oozed false compassion.
"Aye, you do well to make things right with the powers while you still can. Before the spits burned right out of your throat!"
She threw back her head and cackled, the straggling remains of her broom straw hair flying out orange, in the light of the bloated moon. 24. Their horses, led by Rusher, had come to the sound of Roland's dismayed shout. They stood not far away, their manes rippling in the wind, shaking their heads and whinnying their displeasure whenever the wind dropped enough for them to get a whiff of the thick white smoke rising from the canyon. Roland paid no attention to the horses or the smoke. His eyes were fixed on the drawstring sack slung over Alain's shoulder. The ball inside had come alive again. In the growing dark, the bag seemed to pulse like some weird pink firefly. He held out his hands for it. Give it to me. Roland, I don't know if... Give it to me, damn your face! Alain looked at Cuthbert, who nodded, then lifted his hands skyward in a weary, distracted gesture. Roland tore the bag away before Alain could do more than begin to shrug it off his shoulder. The gunslinger dipped into it and pulled the glass out. It was glowing fiercely, a pink demon moon instead of an orange one. Behind and below them, the nagging whine of the thinny rose and fell, rose and fell. "Don't look directly into that thing," Cuthbert muttered to Alain. "Don't, for your father's sake." Roland bent his face over the pulsing ball, its light running over his cheeks and brow like liquid, drowning his eyes in its dazzle. In Merlin's rainbow, he saw her. Susan, horse drover's daughter, lovely girl at the window. He saw her standing in the back of a black cart decorated with gold symbols, the old witch's cart. Reynolds rode behind her, holding the end of a rope that was noosed around her neck. The cart was rolling toward Greenheart, making its way with processional slowness. Hill Street was lined with people, of whom the farmer with the lamb slaughterer's eyes had been only the first, all those folk of Hambry and Magus who had been deprived of their fare, but were now given this ancient dark attraction in its stead. Char you tree, come reap, death for you, life for our crops. A soundless whispering ran through them like a gathering wave, and they began to pelter first with corn husks, then with rotting tomatoes, then with potatoes and apples. One of these latter struck her cheek. She reeled, almost fell, then stood straight again, now raising her swollen but still lovely face so the moon painted it. She looked straight ahead. "Char you tree," they whispered. Roland couldn't hear them, but he could see the words on their lips. Stanley Ruiz was there, and Petty, and Gert Moggins, and Frank Claypool, the deputy with a broken leg. Jamie McCann, who was to have been this year's Reap lad. Roland saw 100 people he had known and mostly liked during his time in Magus. Now these people pelted his love with corn shucks and vegetables as she stood hands bound before her in the back of Rhea's cart. The slowly rolling cart reached Greenheart with its colored paper lanterns and silent carousel where no laughing children rode, no, not this year. The crowd, still speaking those two words, chanting them now, it appeared, parted. Roland saw the heaped pyramid of wood that was the unlit bonfire. Sitting around it, their backs propped on the central column, their lumpy legs outstretched, was a ring of red-handed stuffy guys. There was a single hole in the ring, a single waiting vacancy. And now a woman emerged from the crowd. She wore a rusty black dress and held a pail in one hand. A smear of ash stood out on one of her cheeks like a brand. Roland began to shriek. It was a single word, over and over again. No, 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 no. The ball's pink light flashed brighter with each repetition, as if his horror refreshed and strengthened it. And now, with each of those pulses, Cuthbert and Alain could see the shape of the gunslinger's skull beneath his skin.
"We have to take it away from him," Alain said. "We have to. It's sucking him dry. It's killing him."
Cuthbert nodded and stepped forward. He grabbed the ball, but couldn't take it from Roland's hands. The gunslinger's fingers seemed welded to it.
"Hit him," he told Alain. "Hit him again, you have to."
But Alain might as well have been hitting a post. Roland didn't even rock back on his heels. He continued to cry out that single negative, "No, no, no, no," and the ball flashed faster and faster, eating its way into him through the wound it had opened, sucking up his grief like blood. 25. Charyu Tree!
Cordelia Delgado cried, darting forward from where she had been waiting. The crowd cheered her, and beyond her left shoulder, Demon Moon winked as if in complicity.
Charyu Tree, you faithless bitch! Charyu Tree!
She flung the pail of paint at her niece, splattering her pants and dressing her tied hands in a pair of wet scarlet gloves. She grinned up at Susan as the cart rolled past. The smear of ash stood out on her cheek. In the center of her pale forehead, a single vein pulsed like a worm.
Bitch!
Cordelia screamed. Her fists were clenched. She danced a kind of hilarious jig, feet jumping, bony knees pumping beneath her skirt.
Life for the crops, death for the bitch, Charyu Tree, come reap!
The cart rolled past her. Cordelia faded from Susan's sight, just one more cruel phantasm in a dream that would soon end. Bird and bear and hare and fish, she thought. Be safe, Roland. Go with my love. That's my fondest wish.
Take her, Rhea screamed. Take this murdering bitch and cook her red-handed. Charyu Tree!
Charyu Tree, the crowd responded. A forest of willing hands grew in the moonlit air. Somewhere firecrackers rattled, and children laughed excitedly. Susan was lifted from the cart and handed toward the waiting woodpile above the heads of the crowd, passed by uplifted hands like a heroine returned triumphantly home from the wars. Her hands dripped red tears upon their straining, eager faces. The moon overlooked it all, dwarfing the glow of the paper lanterns.
Bird and bear and hare and fish, she murmured as she was first lowered and then slammed against the pyramid of dry wood put in the place which had been left for her, the whole crowd chanting in unison now,
Charyu Tree! Charyu Tree! Charyu Tree!
Bird and bear and hare and fish,
trying to remember how he had danced with her that night. Trying to remember how he had loved with her in the willow grove. Trying to remember that first meeting on the dark road.
Thank ye, Sai, we're well met, he had said. And yes, in spite of everything, in spite of this miserable ending, with the folk who had been her neighbors turned into prancing goblins by moonlight, in spite of pain and betrayal and what was coming, he had spoken the truth. They had been well met. They had been very well met indeed.
Charyu Tree! Charyu Tree! Charyu Tree!
Women came and piled dry corn shucks around her feet. Several of them slapped her. It didn't matter. Her bruised and puffy face seemed to have gone numb, and one, it was Misha Alvarez, whose daughter Susan had taught to ride, spat into her eyes and then leaped prankishly away, shaking her hands at the sky and laughing. For a moment she saw Coral Thorin festooned with reap charms, her arms filled with dead leaves which he threw at Susan. They fluttered down around her in a crackling, aromatic shower. And now came her aunt again, and Rhea beside her. Each held a torch. They stood before her, and Susan could smell sizzling pitch. Rhea raised her torch to the moon.
Charyu Tree!
She screamed in her rusty old voice, and the crowd responded,
Charyu Tree!
Cordelia raised her own torch.
Come reap!
Come reap! They cried back to her. Now, you bitch, Rhea crooned. Now comes warmer kisses than any your love ever gave you.
Die, you faithless! Cordelia whispered. Life for the crops, death for you.
It was she who first flung her torch into the corn shucks which were piled as high as Susan's knees. Rhea flung hers a bare second later. The corn shucks blazed up at once, dazzling Susan with yellow light. She drew in a final breath of cool air, warmed it with her heart, and loosed it in a defiant shout.
Roland, I love thee!
The crowd fell back, murmuring, as if uneasy at what they had done now that it was too late to take it back. Here was not a stuffy guy, but a cheerful girl they all knew, one of their own, for some mad reason backed up against the Reap Night bonfire with her hands painted red. They might have saved her, given another moment. Some might have, anyway, but it was too late. The dry wood caught, her pants caught, her shirt caught, her long blonde hair blazed on her head like a crown.
Roland, I love thee!
At the end of her life, she was aware of heat, but not pain. She had time to consider his eyes of that blue which is the color of the sky at first light of morning. She had time to think of him on the drop, riding Rusher flat out with his black hair flying back from his temples and his neckerchief rippling. To see him laughing with an ease and freedom he would never find again in the long life which stretched out for him beyond hers. And it was his laughter she took with her as she went out, fleeing the light and heat into the silky, consoling dark, calling to him over and over as she went, calling bird and bear and hare and fish. XXVI. There was no word, not even no, in his screams at the end. He howled like a gutted animal, his hands welded to the ball, which beat like a runaway heart. He watched in it as she burned. Cuthbert tried again to take the cursed thing away and couldn't. He did the only other thing he could think of, drew his revolver, pointed it at the ball, and thumbed back the hammer. He would likely wound Roland, and the flying glass might even blind him, but there was no other choice. If they didn't do something, the glam would kill him. But there was no need. As if seeing Cuthbert's gun and understanding what it meant, the ball went instantly dark and dead in Roland's hands. Roland's stiff body, every line and muscle trembling with horror and outrage, went limp. He dropped like a stone, his fingers at last letting go of the ball. His stomach cushioned it as he struck the ground. It rolled off him and trickled to a stop by one of his limp, outstretched hands. Nothing burned in its darkness now except for one baleful orange spark, the tiny reflection of the rising demon moon. Alain looked at the glass with a species of disgusted, frightened awe. Looked at it as one might look at a vicious animal that now sleeps, but will wake again and bite when it does. He stepped forward, meaning to crush it to powder beneath his boot. "Don't you dare," Cuthbert said in a hoarse voice. He was kneeling beside Roland's limp form, but looking at Alain. The rising moon was in his eyes, two small, bright stones of light. "Don't you dare, after all the misery and death we've gone through to get it. Don't you even think of it." Alain looked at him uncertainly for a moment, thinking he should destroy the cursed thing anyway. Misery suffered did not justify misery to come, and as long as the thing on the ground remained whole, misery was all it would bring anyone. It was a misery machine, that was what it was, and it had killed Susan Delgado. He hadn't seen what Roland had seen in the glass, but he had seen his friend's face, and that had been enough. It had killed Susan, and it would kill more if left whole. But then he thought of Kaa and drew back. Later he would bitterly regret doing so. "Put it in the bag again," Cuthbert said, "and then help me with Roland. We have to get out of here." The drawstring bag lay crumpled on the ground nearby, fluttering in the wind. Alain picked up the ball, hating the feel of its smooth, curved surface, expecting it to come alive under his touch. It didn't, though. He put it in the bag and looped it over his shoulder again. Then he knelt beside Roland. He didn't know how long they tried unsuccessfully to bring him around, until the moon had risen high enough in the sky to turn silver again, and the smoke roiling out of the canyon had begun to dissipate. That was all he knew. Until Cuthbert told him it was enough. They would have to sling him over Rusher's saddle and ride with him that way. If they could get into the heavily forested lands west of Barony before dawn, Cuthbert said, they would likely be safe. But they had to get at least that far. They had smashed Farson's men apart with stunning ease, but the remains would likely knit together again the following day. Best they be gone before that happened. And that was how they left Eyebolt Canyon and the seacoast side of Mages, riding west beneath the demon moon, with Roland laid across his saddle like a corpse. XXVII. The next day they spent in Il Bosque, the forest west of Magus, waiting for Roland to wake up. When afternoon came and he remained unconscious, Cuthbert said, "See if you can touch him." Alain took Roland's hands in his own, marshaled all his concentration, bent over his friend's pale, slumbering face, and remained that way for almost half an hour. Finally, he shook his head, let go of Roland's hands, and stood up. Nothing? Cuthbert asked. Alain sighed and shook his head. They made a travois of pine branches so he wouldn't have to spend another night riding over saddle. If nothing else, it seemed to make Rusher nervous to be carrying his master in such a way, and went on, not traveling on the great road, and that would have been far too dangerous, but parallel to it. When Roland remained unconscious the following day, Magus falling behind them now, and both boys feeling a deep tug of homesickness, inexplicable but as real as tides, they sat on either side of him, looking at each other over the slow rise and fall of his chest. "Can an unconscious person starve or die of thirst?" Cuthbert asked. "They can't, can they?" "Yes," Alain said, "I think they can." It had been a long, nerve-wracking night of travel. Neither boy had slept well the previous day, but on this one they slept like the dead, with blankets over their heads to block the sun. They awoke minutes apart. As the sun was going down and Demon Moon, now two nights past the full, was rising through a troubled rack of clouds that presaged the first of the great autumn storms. Roland was sitting up. He had taken the glass from the drawstring bag. He sat with it cradled in his arms, a darkened bit of magic as dead as the glass eyes of the romp. Roland's own eyes, also dead, looked indifferently off into the moonlit corridors of the forest. He would eat, but not sleep. He would drink from the streams they passed, but not speak. And he would not be parted from the piece of Merlin's rainbow which they had brought out of Magus at such great price. It did not glow for him, however. Not, Cuthbert thought once, while Al and I are awake to see it anyway. Alain couldn't get Roland's hands off the ball, and so he laid his own on Roland's cheeks, touching him that way. Except there was nothing to touch. Nothing there. The thing which rode west with them toward Gilead was not Roland, or even a ghost of Roland. Like the moon at the close of its cycle, Roland had gone. Part 4. All God's Chillin' Got Shoes. Chapter 1. Kansas in the Morning. 1. For the first time in hours, days, the gunslinger fell silent. He sat for a moment, looking toward the building to the east of them. With the sun behind it, the glass palace was a black shape surrounded by a gold nimbus, with his forearms propped on his knees. Then he took the water skin which lay on the pavement beside him, held it over his face, opened his mouth, and upended it. He drank what happened to go in his mouth. The others could see his Adam's apple working as he lay back in the breakdown lane, still pouring, but drinking didn't seem to be his primary purpose. Water streamed down his deeply lined forehead and bounced off his closed eyelids. It pooled in the triangular hollow at the base of his throat and ran back from his temples, wetting his hair and turning it darker. At last he put the waterskin aside and only lay there, eyes closed, arms stretched out high above his head like a man surrendering in his sleep. Steam rose in delicate tendrils from his wet face. "Ah," he said. "Feel better?" Eddie asked. The gunslinger's lids rose, disclosing those faded yet somehow alarming blue eyes. "Yes, I do. I don't understand how that can be, as much as I dreaded this telling, but I do."
"An ologist of the psyche could probably explain it to you," Susanna said, "but I doubt you'd listen."
She put her hands in the small of her back, stretched and winced. But the wince was only reflex. The pain and stiffness she'd expected weren't there. And although there was one small creak near the base of her spine, she didn't get the satisfying series of snaps, crackles, and pops she had expected.
"Tell you one thing," Eddie said, "this gives a whole new meaning to get it off your chest. How long have we been here, Roland?"
"Just one night."
"The spirits have done it all in a single night," Jake said in a dreamy voice.
His legs were crossed at the ankles. Oi sat in the diamond shape made by the boy's bent knees, looking at him with his bright gold-black eyes. Roland sat up, wiping at his wet cheeks with his neckerchief and looking at Jake sharply. "What is it you say?"
"Not me. A guy named Charles Dickens wrote that in a story called A Christmas Carol. All in a single night, huh?"
"Does any part of your body say it was longer?"
Jake shook his head. No, he felt pretty much the way he did any morning, better than on some. He had to take a leak, but his back teeth weren't exactly floating or anything like that.
"Eddie? Susanna?"
"I feel good," Susanna said. "Surely not as if I stayed up all night, let alone many of them."
Eddie said, "It reminds me of the time I spent as a junkie, in a way." "Doesn't everything?" Roland asked dryly.
"Oh, that's funny," Eddie said, "a real howl. Next train that goes crazy on us, you can ask it the silly questions."
"What I meant was that you'd spend so many nights high that you got used to feeling like 10 pounds of shit in a 9-pound bag when you got up in the morning. Bad head, stuffy nose, thumping hot, glass in the old spine. Take it from your pal Eddie, you can just tell from the way you feel in the morning how good dope is for you. Anyway, you'd get so used to that, I did anyway, that when you actually took a night off, you'd wake up the next morning and sit there on the edge of the bed thinking, what the fuck's wrong with me? Am I sick? I feel weird. Did I have a stroke in the night?"
Jake laughed, then clapped a hand over his mouth so violently that it was as if he wanted not just to hold the sound in, but call it back. "Sorry," he said. "That made me think of my dad."
"One of my people, huh?" Eddie said.
"Anyway, I expect to be sore. I expect to be tired. I expect to creak when I walk. But I actually think all I need to put me right is a quick pee in the bushes."
"And a bite to eat?" Roland asked. Eddie had been wearing a small smile. Now it faded.
"No," he said. "After that story, I'm not all that hungry. In fact, I'm not hungry at all."
2. Eddie carried Susanna down the embankment and popped her behind a stand of laurel bushes to do her necessary. Jake was 60 or 70 yards east in a grove of birches. Roland had said he would use the remedial strip to do his morning necessary, then raised his eyebrows when his New York friends laughed. Susanna wasn't laughing when she came out of the bushes. Her face was streaked with tears. Eddie didn't ask her, he knew. He had been fighting the feeling himself. He took her gently in his arms, and she put her face against the side of his neck. They stayed that way for a little while.
"Char-you-tree," she said at last, pronouncing it as Roland had, "char-you-tree," with a little upturned vowel at the end.
"Yeah," Eddie said, thinking that a Charlie by any other name was still a Charlie. As he supposed, a rose was a rose was a rose. "Come reap." She raised her head and began to wipe her swimming eyes.
"To have gone through all that,"
she said, keeping her voice low, and looking once at the turnpike embankment to make sure Roland wasn't there looking down at them.
"And at 14.
"Yeah. It makes my adventures searching for the elusive dime bag in Tompkins Square look pretty tame. In a way, though, I'm almost relieved."
"Relieved? Why?"
"Because I thought he was going to tell us that he killed her himself, for his damn tower." Susanna looked squarely into his eyes.
"But he thinks that's what he did. Don't you understand that?"
3. When they were back together again, and there was food actually in sight, all of them decided they could eat a bit after all. Roland shared out the last of the burritos. "Maybe later today we can stop in at the nearest Boing Boing Burgers and see what they got for leftovers," Eddie thought, and they dug in. All of them, that was, except Roland. He picked up his burrito, looked at it, then looked away. Eddie saw an expression of sadness on the gunslinger's face that made him look both old and lost. It hurt Eddie's heart, but he couldn't think what to do about it. Jake, almost 10 years younger, could. He got up, went to Roland, knelt beside him, put his arms around the gunslinger's neck, and hugged him.
"I'm sorry you lost your friend," he said.
Roland's face worked, and for a moment Eddie was sure he was going to lose it. A long time between hugs, maybe. Mighty long. Eddie had to look away for a moment.
"Kansas in the morning," he told himself. "A sight you never expected to see. Dig on that for a while and let the man be."
When he looked back, Roland had it together again.
Jake was sitting beside him, and Oi had his long snout on one of the gunslinger's boots. Roland had begun to eat his burrito, slowly and without much relish, but he was eating. A cold hand, Susanna's, crept into Eddie's. He took it and folded his fingers over it. "One night," she marveled.
"On our body clocks, at least," Eddie said. "In our heads..."
"Who knows?" Roland agreed. "But storytelling always changes time. At least it does in my world." He smiled. It was unexpected, as always, and as always it transformed his face into something nearly beautiful. Looking at that, Eddie mused, you could see how a girl might have fallen in love with Roland once upon a time. Back when he had been long and going on tall, but maybe not so ugly. Back when the tower hadn't yet got its best hold on him.
"I think it's that way in all worlds, sugar," Susanna said. "Could I ask you a couple questions before we get rolling?"
"If you like."
"What happened to you? How long were you gone?"
"I was certainly gone, you're right about that. I was traveling, wandering. Not in Maryland's Rainbow, exactly. I don't think I ever would have returned from there if I'd gone into it while I was still sick, but everyone has a wizard's glass, of course. Here." He tapped his forehead gravely just above the space between his eyebrows. "That's where I went. That's where I traveled while my friends traveled east with me. I got better there, little by little. I held on to the ball and I traveled inside my head, and I got better. But the glass never glowed for me until the very end, when the battlements of the castle and the towers of the city were actually in sight. If it had awakened earlier..." He shrugged. "If it had awakened before I'd started to get some of my strength of mind back, I don't think I'd be here now. Because any world, even a pink one with a glass sky, would have been preferable to one where there was no Susan. I suppose the force that gives the glass its life knew that, and waited."
"But when it did glow for you again, it told you the rest," Jake said. "It must have. It told you the parts that you weren't there to see."
"Yes. I know as much of the story as I do because of what I saw in the ball."
"You told us once that John Farson wanted your head on a pole," Eddie said, "because you stole something from him, something he held dear. It was a glass ball, wasn't it?"
"Yes, he was more than furious when he found out. He was insane with rage. In your parlance, Eddie, he went nuclear."
"How many more times did it glow for you?" Susanna asked. "And what happened to it?"
Jake added. "I saw in it 3 times after we left Magus Barony," Roland said. "The first was on the night before we came home to Gilead. That was when I traveled in it the longest, and it showed me what I've told you. A few things I've only guessed at, but most I was shown. It showed me these things not to teach or enlighten, but to hurt and wound. The remaining pieces of the wizard's rainbow are all evil things. Hurt enlivens them somehow. It waited until my mind was strong enough to understand and withstand, and then it showed me all the things I missed in my stupid adolescent complacency, my lovesick days, my prideful, murderous conceit."
"Roland, don't," Susanna said. "Don't let it hurt you still."
"But it does. It always will. Never mind. It doesn't matter now. That tale is told. The second time I saw into the glass, went into the glass, was 3 days after I came home. My mother wasn't there, although she was due that evening. She had gone into Debaria, a kind of retreat for women, to wait and pray for my return. Nor was Martin there. He was in Cressia with Farson."
"The ball," Eddie said. "Your father had it by then?"
"No," Roland said. He looked down at his hands, and Eddie observed a faint flush rising into his cheeks. "I didn't give it to him at first. I found it hard to give up."
"I bet," Susanna said. "You and everyone else who ever looked into the goddamn thing."
"On the third afternoon, before we were to be banqueted to celebrate our safe return..."
"I bet you were really in a mood to party, too," Eddie said.
Roland smiled, without humor, still studying his hands. At around 4 o'clock, Cuthbert and Alain came to my rooms. We were a trio for an artist to paint, I wot, wind-burned, hollow-eyed, hands covered with healing cuts and scrapes from our climb up the side of the canyon, scrawny as scarecrows. Even Alain, who tended toward stoutness, all but disappeared when he turned sideways. They confronted me, I suppose you'd say. They'd kept the secret of the ball to that point, out of respect for me and for the loss I'd suffered, they told me, and I believed them. But they would keep it no longer than that night's meal. If I wouldn't give it up voluntarily, it would be a question for our fathers to decide. They were horribly embarrassed, especially Cuthbert, but they were determined. I told them I'd give it over to my own father before the banquet, before my mother arrived by coach from Debaria, even. They should come early and see that I kept my promise. Cuthbert started to hem and haw and say that wouldn't be necessary. But of course it was necessary. Yeah, Eddie said. He had the look of a man who understood this part of the story perfectly. You can go into the crapper on your own, but it's a lot easier to actually flush all the bad shit down the toilet if you have somebody with you. Alain at least knew it would be better for me, easier, if I didn't have to hand the ball over alone. He hushed Cuthbert up and said they'd be there. And they were. And I gave it over, little as I wanted to. My father went as pale as paper when he looked into the bag and saw what was there, then excused himself and took it away. When he came back, he picked up his glass of wine and went on talking to us of our adventures in Magus as if nothing had happened. But between the time your friends talked to you about it and the time you gave it up, you looked into it, Jake said. Went into it. Traveled in it. What did it show you that time? First, the tower again, Roland said. And the beginning of the way there. I saw the fall of Gilead and the triumph of the good man. We'd put those things back a mere 20 months or so by destroying the tankers and the oil patch. I could do nothing about that, but it showed me something I could do. There was a certain knife. The blade had been treated with an especially potent poison, something from a distant mid-world kingdom called Garlan. Stuff so strong even the tiniest cut would cause almost instant death. A wandering singer, in truth John Farson's eldest nephew, had brought this knife to court. The man he gave it to was the castle's chief of domestic staff. This man was to pass the knife on to the actual assassin. My father was not meant to see the sun come up on the morning after the banquet. He smiled at them grimly. Because of what I saw in the wizard's glass, the knife never reached the hand that would have used it, and there was a new chief of domestics by the end of that week. These are pretty tales, I tell you, are they not? Aye, very pretty indeed. Did you see the person the knife was meant for? Susanna asked. The actual killer? Yes. Anything else? Did you see anything else? Jake asked. The plan to murder Roland's father didn't seem to hold much interest for him. Yes, Roland looked puzzled. Shoes. Just for a minute. Shoes tumbling through the air. At first I thought they were autumn leaves. And when I saw what they really were, they were gone, and I was lying on my bed with the ball hugged in my arms, pretty much the way I carried it back from Magus. My father, as I've said, his surprise when he looked inside the bag was very great indeed. You told him who had the knife with the special poison on it, Susanna thought. Jeeves, the butler, or whoever, but you didn't tell him who was supposed to actually use it, did you, Sugar? Why not? Because you wanted to take care of that little spot of work your own self? But before she could ask, Eddie was asking a question of his own. Shoes? Flying through the air? Does that mean anything to you now? Roland shook his head. Tell us about the rest of what you saw in it, Susanna said. He gave her a look of such terrible pain that what Susanna had only suspected immediately solidified to fact in her mind. She looked away from him and groped for Eddie's hand. I cry your pardon, Susanna, but I cannot. Not now. For now I've told all I can. All right, Eddie said. All right, Roland, that's cool.
Cool,
I agreed.
Did you ever see the witch again? Jake asked.
For a long time it seemed Roland would not answer this either, but in the end he did.
Yes, she wasn't done with me. Like my dreams of Susan, she followed me. All the way from Mages, she followed me.
What do you mean? Jake asked in a low, awed voice. Cripes, Roland! What do you mean?
Not now. He got up. It's time we were on our way again. He nodded to the building which floated ahead of them. The sun was just now clearing its battlements. Yon glitter dome's a good distance away, but I think we can reach it this afternoon if we move brisk. 'Twould be best. It's not a place I'd reach after nightfall, if that can be avoided.
Do you know what it is yet? Susanna asked.
Trouble, he repeated. And in our road...